All right, Rabbi, I think we can start because we're trying to, keep everything running smoothly on time. So it's a pleasure to welcome back. I say we're not going to do big Rabbi Israel. We've spoken many times. We look forward to speaking. I think when you're done meeting, I'm going to have to meet you. But anyways, okay. Thank you. Okay, Rabbi Alex, you can get started.
Okay. So I hope that everybody is fasting well or coping well with the fast. And certainly if you're here, you are engaged in a very appropriate mode of marking this somber day. And what I want to do, one of the things, as you I'm sure all know, that the rabbis say that we're not really meant to be studying Torah on this day. This day is not for studying Torah, except for certain passages which are appropriate for the day, which you are able to study because of their sadness. One of the famous ones that you all know, I'm sure, is the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. And this all comes from the Talmud in Gittin, page 56, where there is a whole slew of different stories which narrate some of the horrors of what caused the calamity of the Khurban, but also the, how should I call it, the sociological reality of Jerusalem during the period before the Khurban. And it's fascinating because a lot of these are about food. I know food is maybe something we don't want to think about so much, but if you think about the idea of the Kamsa and Bar Kamsa story, it's about a celebration. It's about high society. High society. Can people hear me? Just want to make sure people can hear me.
Yes, we can all hear you. I'm not sure what that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yes.
The stories are about high society. They're about food and maybe even more than that, feasting. Think about the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. It's about invitations to a party. And why is this? Because there's going to be a focus on social status, on shaming, on, we're going to see focus on gender, on prestige, on feasting, on fasting, on starving. These stories, instead of maybe taking the whole, imagine if you read a history book, you'd hear about the great revolts and what started in the year 66 and when the Romans came along and the year 70. Here we're going to tell small human stories. You know, it's actually something that we're used to from our newscasting, that sometimes the news doesn't tell the big story anymore. It goes in and tells a particular story about a certain individual, a certain family, somebody who's experiencing some difficulty. And through that micro story, through that the micropolitics of daily life, as somebody once called it, we can illuminate the complexities of the broader social dimensions of disaster. And therefore, this is very clear in Kamsa Bar Kamsa. And food and wealth are going to come into this story in a very big way. And this is where I'm already going to jump in. Today, we're going to learn the story about a woman called Martha Bat Baitus. She was called one of the wealthy people of Yerushalayim. That's her name in the story. And we're going to learn about her tragedy. And I'm going to share my screen so that we can start already studying source sheet. Okay, so I hope people are with me and can see the source sheet, and we're in good shape. I want to start off with a story here, which is going to tell a story about the power of the wealthy people of Jerusalem, and maybe even their piety. Let me explain what I mean here. Let's take a look at this story where we talk about Vespasian, the emperor, and maybe what we will do, or the Caesar, as he's called, is, and maybe what we'll do is we'll read a little bit in some of the Hebrew or the Aramaic and the English. So, Shadrei Lavelas Pesanus Caesar, Asar Tsar Alat Lat Shani. We have the notion that Vespasian has besieged Jerusalem for 3 years. And what do we hear at this point? We hear about three wealthy people, that there are Hanu Tlat Atire, these three men of great wealth, and their names are Nachdimon Ben Gurion, Ben Kalba Savua, Ben Sitzit HaKesef. Okay? Nachdimon Ben Gurion, Kalba Savua, and Ben Sitzit HaKesef. Why? Nachdimon Ben Gurion Shenachdalo Chama Ba'Aguron. This is a story that the sun continued shining for his sake. It's a story about Nachdimon Ben Gurion, who wanted to try and make sure that there was water for all of the people who came for Aliyah LeRegel. In other words, Nachdimon Ben-Gurion, and I assume that Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion of modern times, his name was actually Green, his family name, and he obviously decided to take on this name for this person being one of the famous leaders of Jerusalem before its destruction. And then we have Ben Kalba Savua, and why? He was so wealthy that anybody went to his house as a kelev, as a hungry as a dog, came out sabea, came out full. In other words, once again, Ben Kalba Savua is somebody who is tremendously hospitable. And Tzitzit HaKesef is called so because his tzitzit would trail upon cushions. He had wall-to-wall carpeting in his home. So we have a situation in which these are the wealthy people. And other people say that no, it's not from that. It's that he got his name from the fact that his seat, his kisei, was among the nobility of Rome. That he was somebody who used to be able to live in high society. And I'm giving you this whole backdrop in order to set the scene for Jerusalem and for understanding something about Jerusalem and the type of people we have here. Let's take this one stage further. And what did they do when we have this siege? How are these three people going to be involved in the siege? So I'm going to read in the English here. I think it'll save us a lot of time. And we don't have so much time. One of them said to the people of Jerusalem, I will keep the people in wheat and barley. In other words, I can pay for all the grain in this city. A second said, I will keep them in wine, oil, and salt. The third said, I will keep them in wood. So we've basically got possibilities to have grain, wine, oil, salt, and even wood for heating. And the rabbis considered the offer of wood the most generous. Whichever way, the important line here, I'll scroll up a little bit, is, these men were in a position to keep the city for 21 years. We all know that part of the strategy of armies who are besieging a city is that they hope that the city will run out of supplies and they will be able to thereby vanquish the city. And here we find that these wealthy people were capable and willing to support the city and to leave the city for 21 years. We also know that Jerusalem had all sorts of water stores and what have you. But here we go. Now we're going to see a different machlokas. The Birioni, the zealots, were in the city. The rabbi said, let's go make peace with the Romans. The zealots wouldn't let them. On the contrary, they said, let's go fight them. The rabbi said, you won't succeed. So what did they do? They rose up and burnt the stores of wheat and barley so that a famine would ensue. And what are we seeing here? We're seeing the idea, and sometimes this indeed is the notion that we see the notion that the city really could have survived for a long time, but we were the ones, the Jewish people, who our infighting and our ideological battles between the rabbis who seem to have been willing to make a compromise and between the zealots who weren't willing to make a compromise. We're the ones where we say that sinat chinam, the infighting, was something which brought us down. I think we're referring to events such as this where it was actually our people, our own people, who burnt the storehouses of Jerusalem. and thereby brought the city. And a feature I'm sure you know of Eicha is that the idea of starvation in the city, the children and the mothers with their babies and not being able to even feed their babies, the merciful women who had to even resort to eating the flesh of their dead children, the idea of starvation and famine, which eventually, and then the death, which brought pandemic and illness to the city, all of this brought the city down. Why did it happen? Because of political fights between the extremists on the right, between the people on the left, and eventually we brought about our own demise. So this is one of the features of the story, and now we're going to hone in on one particular story here of one very wealthy lady. Martaba Baitus Atirata Yerushalayim Hazna. She was, if you want, the most wealthy woman of Jerusalem. She sent her servant and said, Zil Aitili Samina, please bring me some fine flour. Ata Azil, there were famine. By the time he went to the store, it was sold out. Ata Marley, Smida Leka, Hivarta Ika. There's no fine flour, but there's white flour. She said, bring it. I'll skip to the English and maybe that'll help us. Okay? She says, there's no fine flour, there's white flour. So she said to him, go bring me some. By the time he went, he found the white flour sold out. He came and told her, there's no white flour, but there's dark flour. She said to him, go bring me some. By the time he went, it was sold out. He returned and said to her, there's no dark flour, but there's barley flour. She said, go bring me some. By the time he went, this was also sold out. She had taken off her shoes, but she said, I will, now, by the way, until now, this almost sounds like a comedy of errors, right? There's a whole type of humor where you have wealthy people who have a bumbling servant, and the bumbling servants, right, kind of get it right. I don't know, some of you might remember 40 Towers with Manuel. And you have these situations where this is a classic type of comedy. This is a very, very black comedy, as we will see in the next line. She had taken off her shoes and she said, I'll go out and see if I can find anything to eat. And as she went out into the street, some dung stuck to her foot and she died. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai applied to her this verse. She who is most tender and delicate among you, so tender and dainty that she would never venture to set foot on the ground. And this is from Devarim chapter 28. And we're going to look at this in a moment. So that's one version. Then how did Marta pass away? She passed away because she was in the situation of being so shocked. This aristocratic woman whose foot had never set foot on the ground, suddenly she sticks her foot into a pile of manure, right? The shock literally killed her. And in fact, I was just reading today, this morning, some of the accounts from the Holocaust, from various, the first deportations of the German Jews, the Jews from Prague, and many of these people who had been, were the first people to be deported, were in fact people, professionals, aristocracy, and they talk about the number of people who committed suicide on the trains, on the cattle cars, because just the thought of being in these squalid, awful conditions was something that they just couldn't even fathom. Right? It was maybe the hardy Jews who survived the Holocaust. These aristocratic Jews didn't even last the awful, hot, parched train ride. And so many of them, she took their own lives. So that's one of the versions. Some report a different version. She ate a fig left by Rabbi Tzadok and became sick and died. For Rabbi Tzadok observed fast for 40 years in order that Jerusalem might not be destroyed. And he became so thin that when he ate anything, the food could be seen as it passed through his throat. He was always fasting, but when he wanted to restore himself, they would bring him a fig and he would suck the juice and throw the rest away. And again, what happened? She ran into the street. She didn't have any bread because the bread was all sold out. And she picked up a fig which was already a second-hand fig, and she became sick and died. Interestingly, the thing which kept Rabbi Tzadok alive killed her. When Martha was about to die, she brought out all her gold and silver and threw it in the street, saying, "What good is this to me?" As in the verse from Ezekiel, they cast their silver in the street. So this, at some level, is a terrible tale of woe, which wants to maybe give us a glimpse into the tragedy of Jerusalem through its aristocracy, through the how is she called here, the tender and dainty, the tender and delicate. And we see the tragedy by seeing these well-heeled people of, and some of you might have visited in Jerusalem, the burnt house or the archaeology under Yeshivat HaKotel, and you see the mansions of the people in Jerusalem. And we now know pretty much that probably Martha Baitus was probably one of those people, because that neighborhood was a neighborhood of priests. And soon we're going to see that Martha ben Baitus wasn't just married to a priest. She was, in fact, married to the high priest himself. So on your source sheet, there's a whole sort of questions, because I actually prepared this source sheet for a session where we were going to have Chavruta. But I want to read this story. I call this Martha ben Baitus text and subtext. And I want to read this two ways. The first way I want to read this is as a classic tale of tragedy. And I think there are many sources which read it that way. And if we're going to see it in this regard, I think what we want to see is the source text that they bring here, which I'm going to highlight right now, is source text of that line which says, "The tender and delicate among you who never feet have never touched the soil." Here, it's right over here. Haraka b'chava anuga asher lo nista kaf ragla hatsegal aretz v'taneg u'meroch teira ina v'ishcheka u'bivna u'bita. So what's going on there? What is that text? And again, unfortunately, the text stretches from the top of page. Maybe I'll make it a little smaller. This will help us. The text is from Devarim chapter 28. And chapter 28 is, in fact, the Tochacha. The Tochacha tells us that if we follow the laws of the Torah, we will have blessing. But if we reject the laws of the Torah, we will have all sorts of curse. And let's take a look at how we're going to read this. Tisar Hashem Alecha Goy Mirachok. The Lord will bring a nation from far away, from the ends of the earth, like an eagle swooping down. Kashe Yideh HaNeshe. Goy Hashem Lo Tishma Neshono. Nation you will not recognize their language. V'achal Pi Ben D'chal Pi Ad Matchad Yishim Dich. At Ishamedcha. They'll devour the young of your livestock and the crops of your land until you're destroyed. They will leave you no grain, no wine or oil. They'll lay siege to all the cities throughout your land until the high fortified walls in which you trust fall down. So we've got the notion here, of course, of the devastation of the countryside, right? A foreign invasion. The siege, right, which of course we know from Asara B'Tevet and Shiva Asam Tamuz. And now, getting even more frightening, it talks about, because of the suffering your enemy will inflict on you during the siege, you will eat the fruit of your womb, the flesh of your sons and daughters that the Lord has given you, right? This is V'achalta Pribit Necha, B'sar Banecha U'Bnotecha Asher Natan Lecha Hashem Elokecha B'matzor U'V'matzok Asher Yitzik Lecha Oivecha. The most terrifying, horrific scenes. And then even talks about how even the most gentle and sensitive man among you will have no compassion on his brother or his wife, the wife that he loves or surviving children. He will not give any of them the flesh of his children that he's eating. It will be all he has left because of his suffering. And now, if the men aren't compassionate, that's one thing. But now the most gentle, sensitive women among you, so sensitive and gentle, they would not venture to touch the ground with the sole of their foot, will begrudge the husband she loves and her son and daughter. So the Midrash in Gittin tells this terrible story of this woman who, by the way, if you understand the story, right, she goes and tells her servant, go get me fine flour, because that's what she's used to eating. He comes back and he's like, oh gosh, she doesn't eat anything but fine flour. She goes, okay, then white flour. She can't even imagine. She doesn't just say, go get everything. Go get whatever there is. She can't imagine eating not white flour. Then she says, maybe brown flour, maybe barley. In the end, everything's right. It gives you a sense that once the food runs out, it runs out so fast. She's got no time to adjust. And a woman who's used to eating fine flour then is in a situation when she eventually her dainty foot meets this pile of dung in the street. The shock is so intense. By the way, all of this is described by Sefer Dvarim. Im lo tishmor la'asod et kol Torah hazot. It's all a punishment for not keeping the Torah. Now again, we ask ourselves, who is this woman, Marta Bat Vitus? And here we go to see in Eicha Rabbah another story, which gives us, helps us understand. And we're going to see a different version, a third version of her death. Okay. So we're going to have to wonder what exactly is the true story of her death. We've already had two versions. Version number one, she put her foot in a pile of manure. Number two, she was so hungry, she ate a fig that Rabbi Tzadok had sucked, and that made her sick. And the third story we'll read now. But let's see. Ma'aseh b'Miriam b'Matos. Here we go. Ma'aseh, this is from Eicha Rabbah, which again we're also allowed to read on this day. One second. I'm just looking at the, I'm not going to be able to look at the chat in real time. It's just a bit too much for me to cope with. I'll take a look at it at the end. We have a story about this woman. Her Hebrew name apparently is Miriam. So it's interesting that she's referred to as somebody who is, has a Hebrew name and she has a Roman name. Marta, Miriam, Shekicha Yoshua ben Gamla, that when she became engaged to Yoshua ben Gamla, Minua Melech Liot Kohen Gadol, that the king appointed Yoshua ben Gamla to become the Kohen Gadol. This is really fascinating. We're going to see more about this betrothal in a second. But the idea that she's married to the Kohen Gadol is amazing. And you wonder, the king, was the king interested in Yeshua ben Gamla, or was the king more interested in Martha ben Baitus? In other words, is it that Yeshua ben Gamla was going to be the Kohen Gadol and she married him, or was it that once he married the richest woman in Jerusalem, he got the job of becoming Kohen Gadol? We'll come to that in a second. Pamachat, Nichlasa Pamachat Lirot, Vamra Elech Ve'ereotom Kasheu Kore B'yom HaKippurim B'Beit HaMikdash. We all know that the key day of the high priest is Yom Kippur. And it seems that she didn't used to go and watch him on a regular basis. But there was one Yom Kippur where she said, you know what, I would like to go and see him on Yom Kippur. Bo'etziu la taftafiyot mi petach beitza ad petach beit hamikdash. And they put out carpets. They laid out literally the red carpet from her house all the way to the entrance of the Beit HaMikdash. So that her feet not be, right, exposed. But here's a woman who's not used to leaving the house. She's not used to leaving her mansion. They have to actually take out Yom Kippur and carpet the entire route to the Beit HaMikdash. And when her husband died, she outlived her husband. They gave her a allotment of 2 seah of wine, which is a huge volume every day. Right? And but don't we say you don't usually assign wine to a woman? And they go through all of this. The assumption being that what did she need it for? That she was that her wine was a basic foodstuff. And let's see the last story of her death. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok. Skipping down a little bit. Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok said, Ere ben Achama, may I live to see the consolation of Jerusalem if I did not see her hair tied to the tails of the horses as they dragged her to her death from Jerusalem to Lod. And I applied this verse to her, again, the same verse. She who is most tender and delicate among you, so tender and dainty she would never venture to set a foot on the ground, shall be judged the husband of her bosom and the son of her daughter. Again, according to this, Martha Bambitis becomes a symbol of the terrifying fate of Jerusalem, because look how she died. According to this, and maybe it isn't her, because how can you have three stories about the death of a single woman? But what we have here is a story of her death, where they deliberately took the aristocratic women, tied their hair to the tails of horses, and ran through the streets until obviously they died from battery and from their skin being ripped away from them. And this is what we have. Terrible story of Martha Bambitis. And what I want to say is, this is reading number one. If you read through the Gemara, you'd read it and you'd say, ay, 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 this is just so terrible. However, I think there is a subtext, and it's a subtext that we can get both from what we know about her and in other places, and also by reading the story. Already I see in the chat here, which I know I said I wasn't going to read, but somebody writes that Martha must have caused a lot of extra work, presumably for regular people on a fast day on Yom Kippur. She could have declined special treatment, and I would agree with that 100%. And there is no doubt that there is another side to the Martha Bambitis story, and let's take a look at it a little bit more, looking at the Gemara, a few other bits of backstory about this woman. And here you see it's source number 5, to Amar Rabbi Asi. How did Martha Bambitis's husband become the high priest? Adamar Avasi Tirkama de Dinare, a whole purse of dinar. Ailile Martha Bambitis Yana Malka, Altukmina Oshua Ben Gamla, Kane Ravrave. She paid a purse of dinari, some people say a million dinari, to Yanai the king, so that he would appoint Yoshua Ben Gamla as the high priest. Oh gosh. Here we have a situation where her husband doesn't get the high priesthood by right, but he gets it by her buying her way in. I'll give you another example of something they say about her son. Amru Abnashel Martha Bambitis. They tell a story about Martha Bambitis's son, Shayanotel Shteyre Fochel Shor HaGadol. Usually, by the way, when you have the sacrifices, they are divided up into many, many different sections, and a different Kohen takes each section to the altar. But it says that the son of Martha Bambitis would take the two thighs of a large ox, which are obviously very, very, very heavy, shelakuach be'elef zuz, bought at a price of 1,000 zuz. Right? Remember, we know that a dezabin abba betray zuze, that a goat, a kid goat, cost 2 zuz, and he would walk heel to toe. In other words, he would walk in a very slow and stately manner. Umalach akeid b'tzad gudal v'lohi nichwa ha'konim lasokei mishum barov am hadrat melech. And the brothers, the priests, wouldn't let him do this due to the rule with many people is the honor of the king. In other words, there was an argument between the Kohanim, where some Kohanim wanted to, how should I put it? They wanted to grandstand. They wanted to show off. They wanted to stand there striding all alone. Obviously, by the way, this guy, Martha Bambitis, not Miriam, but Martha, lived in high Roman society, as we've heard. And it's almost as if this son is engaging in almost an athletic feat of walking slowly through the people, through the Azara, where everybody watches him and could see him. Yes, possibly the son himself was the upcoming Kohen Gadol, who knows? And the Kohanim say, no, this is not the right way to run the temple. Barovam Hadrat Melech. We should share the goods around. I'm not sure exactly where to go, how far further to go with this, but you know what? Maybe I'll tell you another very frightening story about this particular group of Kohanim. And let's take a look at source number 7. And again, I feel that these sources are pretty appropriate because even if Marta Bat Baitos was part of the aristocracy, and even if she wasn't a particularly nice lady, I still think we can see stories like this as highlighting and giving a window into the tragedy of Jerusalem. But we might see this story, and remember, the proof text that they keep on quoting for her comes from the Tochacha. And the Tochacha says, essentially, that all this trouble, strife, famine, and terrible, you know, devastation comes as a result of our actions. Let's take a look at source number 7, the Gemara and Pesachim, and then I want to go back to the story and do something of a literary reading of it. Tanu Rabbanan, Roshanah yom manichim orot kodshim b'lishkat beit ha'parva. Le'erev hayum chalkim otam l'anshei beit av. The rabbis taught the first they used to take the skins of the sacrifices to the chamber called the Beit HaParva and the Beit HaMikdash. And what they would do is they would divide it up to the Beit Av. There were certain groups of Kohanim. For particular, we have the Kina about them that we said this morning. 24 groups of Kohanim. And they used to come up for 2 weeks a year to do their Miluim. And they'd all be there for the Chagim. And they would each be in certain groups. And they would divide the skins of the animals between them. So the skins, obviously, were very valuable. However, there were certain people who would muscle in on them and use violence to seize them. So they said, okay, well, if these ruffians come along every night, let's do it collectively every Erev Shabbat. There'll be more people there and they won't come along. Now we find out who the ruffians are. Who were the ruffians? Okay? The Gedolei Kohuna, the chief priests who seized them by force. And so what takes to happen, instead of donating them to the Kohanim, Amdu Ba'alim of Hikdishum Ashamayim. A person who would bring sacrifice, instead of giving the donation of the skin to the priests, he would then say, I'm donating this to God, these are Hekdesh, and therefore no one can have them. In other words, the temple didn't know what to do with all of these animal skins, and eventually they would sell them off and bought loads of gold until the temple was covered with gold from all of this. Whichever way, who are these violent Kohanim who create this situation? And it says, I'll go to the end. It was taught, Abba Shaul said, there were sycamore trunk tree trunks in Jericho, and men of violence seized them by force, whereupon the owners arose and consecrated them to heaven as well. And it was of these and such that Abba Shaul ben Botnik said in the name of Abba Yosef ben Kanin, and here is the phrase I'll show you in the Hebrew, Oili mi beit baitos, oili mi avatan. Woe is to me from the house of Boethus. Woe is to me because of their clubs. Oili mi beit chanin, oili mi litchishatan, oili mi beit katrois, oili mi kulmusan. Woe is to me of the house of chanin because their whisperings. They maybe lamalshinim. Maybe they tell the authorities. Woe to me is the house of katros. Woe to me is because of their pens. They write letters to, I don't know, the authorities, etc., etc. For these are high priests and their sons of temple treasurers and their sons-in-law trustees and their servants beat the people with staves. This is already getting exceedingly nasty. This is not only wealth and disdain for servants who have to put out heavy carpets on Yom Kippur when the servants themselves are fasting. This is not only paying your way to the high priesthood. This is not only having a son who wants to grandstand in the temple. But here we're talking about violence, taking the skins of the animal because you want to get wealthy off them and using violence, clubs, staves, in order to create a violent environment. These are the families of the high priests. What's going on here? This is just awful. You know, when you go to Jerusalem and I think sure many of you have walked through the old city to the Kotel, you pass by something called the Burnt House. And the Burnt House, they actually found in the Burnt House a cup, and the cup on it says Katros. Katros is the name of one of those families of high priests. Just across the way, underneath the Shiata Kotel, they have excavated, and they find these phenomenal mansions, each, of course, with mikvaot in the basement. Not just one mikvah, but many mikvaot, and that leads us to indicate that these are people who would eat all their food in sanctity. They would eat truma, they would eat maaser, they would eat kochim, and these are the neighborhoods of the aristocracy, of the high priests. They could look out their windows and see the temple because they're right on the edge of the hill, right? But now we actually can see the homes, and we can even imagine somebody having to put carpets all the way down to that valley by the Kotel and then up the stairs, which went up into the temple. We can almost imagine the distances. We can almost picture it. And this is Marta Bat Vitus, our, I don't know what we want to call her, heroine or protagonist or whatever we want to call her. So here we're seeing that on the one hand, on a first read, this is a story of woe and a story of tragedy. But what are we exactly going to say? And here, of course, I think people have already understood that. I'll go back to the sheet. That we're telling a tale here of somebody who has never walked outside. She has this let them eat cake attitude. The whole country, the whole city is under siege. The enemy are coming in. There's a rush on flour, and she's like sitting there listening to reordering the her servant is like the person reordering the deck chairs on the deck of the Titanic. She's still having her wondering what the menu is going to be for dinner that night. She has no clue what is coming. There's something tragic about it, but there's also something so atum, so, I don't know, covered in silk from it all off that she can't even imagine. By the way, why does a servant keep coming back to her all the time? Each time, and I said it's like a bumbling black comedy, but I think it's more than that. Servant's terrified from his mistress. If he doesn't come back with the best food from the market, he gets eaten. Maybe he himself will get beaten. Maybe he will get, this is not a very sympathetic woman. And therefore he makes sure, and he doesn't dare come back from the market. If she says get fine flour, she gets fine flour. White flour, but she doesn't dare do anything without a permission. So he's constantly coming back to get his marching orders because he's terrified about what she's going to say and what she's going to do. And of course, let me deal with the three versions of her death. Version number one, of course, is that she touches a piece of manure, a fulfillment of that pasuk. But I think, of course, we have the contrast between this woman whose foot has never touched the ground, even on Yom Kippur, when everybody is barefoot, right? Don't want to imagine. She is not enough for her to be barefoot through the streets, right? She has to make sure it's not enough for put on a pair of maybe cloth shoes. She has to have carpets. She never goes anywhere uncarpeted. And it's exactly this lack of exposure that suddenly when her foot hits the harsh reality, when it hits the manure, suddenly it's like this earthquake in her life. Is this total earthquake in her life. And she embodies this sense of the absolute. She's stuck inside. She's stuck inside. She's inside her world. She's inside her palace. She's totally not exposed. And that shows the insensitivity of maybe she's the contrast supposed to be great. Wealthy men we heard about before, Nachdimon Ben Gurion, who was happy to use all of his wealth to provide the Jerusalem with wheat and barley for 21 years. And we had Kalba Savua, who was going to provide the wine and the oil, and Ben Sisdel HaKesed, who was going to provide all of, they were happy to give. She's not giving. She's taking. She's all about her standing. She's about making sure that her husband is the high priest. Her son's got this sense of, it's all the way we look, right? And her own servants are a violent group who strike fear even into the sacred temple. So here we definitely get a sense that there's something very awry about the world of Martha Bat Vitus. The second version of her, and of course, by the way, the irony is that she ends up, of course, throwing all of her gold and silver into the street. There's this sense of everything which is thrown away, right? Whatever you find in the street. So we'll talk about that in a second. The second comparison, or the second story, is this idea of the contrast between Rabbi Tzadok and Martha. Because let's again look at Rabbi Tzadok. Some report that she ate a fig left by Rabbi Tzadok and became sick and died. And what's Rabbi Tzadok? Because Rabbi Tzadok observed fast for 40 years in order that Jerusalem might not be destroyed. Here we have the wealthy and the people who eat all the time, and they only eat the finest, and they only have the most beautiful stuff. And Rabbi Tzadok is already fasting 40 years in Jerusalem. She's not doing anything to make sure that Jerusalem is not destroyed. She's totally ensconced in her mollycoddled environment, in her wealthy environment. But he already, 40 years, is somebody who is praying and fasting. He's not eating so that Jerusalem might not be destroyed. And he became so thin that what he ate, and he ate anything, the food could be seen as it passed through his throat. When he wanted to destroy himself, he then bring him a fig and suck the juice and throw it away. How did she die? Right? Because she ate the fig. She's allergic to Rabbi Tzadok fig. Rabbi Tzadok and Martha are polar opposites. Martha is totally insulated. She is all about the outside. She's all about the image. She's all about her carpets, her clothing, her insulation. Right? Rabbi Tzadok is all about the inside. He takes the juice and he discards the actual outside. He's all about inside. When he eats, you can actually see it going down his throat because he is so gaunt. So Rabbi Tzadok, you can see his inside. So there's this concept in halacha or in ethics of tocho kufaro, somebody whose inside is like his outside. They're so genuine. They're so thorough. But so Rabbi Tzadok is all about the inside. She's all about the externalities. And therefore, he's the opposite of Martha. And I'd say even more than that. Martha can't even see 2 yards in front of her nose. She has no clue when there's no flour, when there's no brown flour. There's no. Eventually, her moment of her death is when she steps out of the door of the house. She can't look outside. She can't look beyond. She certainly can't look ahead. She's again the contrast to those wealthy men who foresaw the future and were happy to insulate Jerusalem for 21 years. She, you know, of course, that 21 is 3 times 7. 7 being the classic amount, 3 men times 7. And she can't see what's coming around the corner. Rabbi Tzadok, on the other hand, 40 years before, is already predicting. Not only is he predicting, but he is trying to fend off the terrible Korban by his own starvation. He's trying to fend off starvation and death by his own Spartan lifestyle, where he's going to pray and plead and live in this environment whereby he can save the city. So we see this tremendous contrast between all of them. Is the sound back? Are we okay with the sound?
The sound is a little choppy. I assume it's something on your end, the transmission from Israel, but I don't know. You can hear it. Pay attention. I think for Tisha B'Av, it's, you know, it's appropriate on Tisha B'Av the sound be a little bit choppy. It's going to be, but usually okay. It's fine. Yeah. I hope I just my end. I don't know other people, but go ahead.
Hold on a minute. I'll...
Clearly, yeah. I mean, it's rare, but these things do happen occasionally. Of course, it happens to happen. We have the most people we ever have all year, but okay. Rabbi, you okay?
Okay. I don't know if this is... No.
No, just go on as you were doing before.
I'm just trying to get back on. And...
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I hope this will help. I don't know if this is any better.
No, I would say it's worse.
What's now?
You have to talk a little more.
Okay. All right. What we're going to do is we're going to go to the final source. And the final source, I'll stop my share. Maybe that's what I'll do. One minute. Okay, I apologize about the problems with the sound. I meant to have a very fast system here. I'm not quite sure what happened with the sound, but I hope that this will make things a little better and easier to hear. And what I want to do is just read the last chapter as well, and the last source as well, source number 8, which I think you probably have in front of you. What you can see is that these stories aren't necessarily about one individual person. Because if I read the final story that we have here, the final story is seems to be very, very similar to the others, but it's almost like a variation on the theme. Let's take a look at what we have here. If you take a look at source number, the final source on the sheet, I'm just getting my place. Source number 8. Rabbi Yehuda related in the name of Rav. It once happened that the daughter of Nachtimon ben Gurion, and now you see a different woman. Remember Nachtimon, it was granted by the sages an allowance of 400 gold coins in respect of a perfume basket for one day. In other words, when they decided on her ketubah, they put in that she was allowed 400 zuz for her perfume, just for a single day. And she said to them, she cursed the rabbis and says, may God give you those allowances for your own daughters. And they all answered, amen. In other words, she was so used to living, with designer standards, with the most expensive brands, things that the rabbis could never even imagine. And she was insulted. And they were like, yeah, please, if only. Our eyes taught it once happened that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai left Jerusalem riding upon an ass. We all know Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai survived the Churban while his disciples followed him. And he saw a girl picking up barley grains in the dung of the Arab cattle. As soon as she saw him, she wrapped herself with hair. Apparently, she didn't have any clothes on. She had such tatters. The only way she should cover her modesty was wrapping herself in her hair. And she stood before him and said, Master, she said, feed me. And he says, my daughter, who are you? And she said, I'm the daughter of Nachtimon ben Gurion. My daughter, he said to her, what's become of the wealth of your father's house? Master, she said, is there not a proverb in Jerusalem? The salt of money is diminution. And when the master said, where is the wealth of your father's house? This one came and destroyed the other. Do you remember, Master, she said, when you signed my ketubah? I remember, he said, that when I signed the ketubah of this unfortunate woman, I read therein 1,000,000 golden denarii from her father's house, besides the amount from her father-in-law's house. And the Gemara then continues and gives the same story that we saw with Nachtimon ben, with Marta ben Baitus. And you know what really happened to her? Eventually, they tied her hair to the horses, and that was how she died. What we see here in these stories is just the phenomenal wealth on the one hand of the people of Yerushalayim, but the fact that they are insulated from the problems of the common people, that they live on such a high standard that they really had no clue what was going on outside their front door. And the minute that they leave their front door, they die because they can't cope with the shock. And here, I just wanted to maybe finish lots of people have examined this story and have said that in the classic, you remember, we're talking about Roman times. You look at the classic Roman tragedy. In the classic Roman tragedy, there are four stages of the tragedy. Frequently, the story is about a person who is a protagonist, the hero, frequently a king or a prince or somebody who's high up in society. Stage two, right, is where the figure has a tragic flaw, right? They have a flaw. And in this case, it might be, you know, indeed their hubris, their corruption, their violence. And then we have, of course, the punishment, the nemesis, right? Where the downfall of the hero. This is the classic story of tragedy. And usually the classic Greek story has to have the individual recognizing their flaws, recognizing, doing tshuva. That's exactly what we have in this story. It's almost written in that Roman style because you have Marta Baitos so wealthy. Then we have the fact that the food's running out and she can't catch up. She's got no way of surviving in this rough and tumble environment, in this desperate rush for food. And of course, what we have here at this point is we have the story with her throwing her, the retribution, of course, is her death in some way. But before she dies, she takes all her silver and gold and throws it into the street. And that throwing of the silver and gold is the opposite of Rav Tzadok throwing his fig out. She's throwing the silver and gold because it has no use to her. And she has realized at some level that it is her silver and gold which have made her deaf. Deaf to what's going on around her, deaf to the poor people, deaf to the Kohanim of Jerusalem, deaf to the suffering of her servants. And that it was actually the Kohanim themselves and their corrupt behavior which brought about, or is at least party to bringing about the destruction of Jerusalem. So this is the story of Martha Bat Baitus, text and subtext, a terrible, terrible tale. You know, I'm sure I don't, you know, I think the story speaks for itself in so many ways. I'm not going to articulate messages and therefore we can all learn and we should all do this and we should all do that. This is a day. I'm not sure it's a day for me to be giving any musar, certainly not musar to people from communities who live far from me and I really don't know intimately. But I think we can all think for ourselves about the sensitivity, about the inbuilt structural paradigms which are within our community, about the need for all of us to be able to open up our hearts to all sorts of other people around us. And if we do some of that, then maybe we will be able to bring about a reversal of the Churban and a journey towards Geula. Thank you very much and a good fast to you all. And hopefully we'll meet on happier days. And maybe I'll just end with hopes and prayers that the current violence in Israel, in Gaza, comes to a very swift end. There's a lot of talk about a ceasefire tonight. And as we say, Shalom, Shalom, Yerushalayim, we pray for the peace of Yerushalayim. That's true today, maybe even more than just every other day.
Thank you, Rabbi Alex. You want to take there? I think there are a couple of questions you may not have addressed. You can spend a minute or two on that. I know there was a lot of. I see right at the end. If you want to see Stephen.
I apologize about the sound. I'm not quite sure what happened.
It could be, you know, just sometimes that's what happens. Like it's beyond everybody's control. It's, you know, how the international lines work. So, although I will say somebody sent me an email to recommend that it might be better. I want to thank, you know, Shalom sent me an email to that. If he says, if you call in on the phone, sometimes the phone sound might be better. I've never done that, but you can try that on the Zoom link. There is a phone number for people to call.
I recently changed my computer system and it was meant to be much, much faster and it's doing much, much less well. Anyway, here we go. Stephen asked the question. It seems like there are two traditions about temple era: sinfulness, one about sinat chinam, and clueless materialism. All these dueling interpretations. I don't know. There is a Gemara in Masechet Brach, I think, Shabbat. I'm forgetting now. Al ma charva Yerushalayim, with a whole series of explanations. Why was Jerusalem destroyed? And there are a huge number of interpretations and explanations about what led to the destruction of Jerusalem. And I think that each of these different agadot, each of these different tales and legends takes us into a different sort of like framework. And so I don't know if they're dueling interpretations. Maybe they are. Some of them do seem to be connected to historical, but you will find in the rabbinic tradition, you know, tens, if not, you know, certainly tens of interpretations of what led to Jerusalem. Some of them have made it more famous than others, like the Sinat Chinam one. But this, certainly what I presented today, is one interpretation.
If I may add to that, I think clueless materialism, as he puts it, and Sinat Chinam are two sides of the same coin. When there's too much materialism and money and fighting for everything, it's going to lead to Sinat Chinam. I think the two are deeply connected. But anyways, okay. Any other questions? Otherwise, thank you, Rabbi Alex. You can go eat in 5 minutes. Yeah, we'll start in about 3-4 minutes. Rabbi Gedalia Berger, if you haven't had the pleasure of hearing him, he's going to be on this side of the Atlantic. So he will be speaking on actually the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. He teaches at Chipatz. He teaches at the Oetzet Halakha program. And he spoke once, Parsha, and he was very, very good. So he should be on in a couple of minutes. And I know he actually told me he had a funeral, unfortunately, this morning, but he's
here.
Oh, you're here. Here you are. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Should have simchas. Okay. Let me just make you co-host. Are you in as Gedalia? How are you in Gedalia Berger? Okay. We're going to let people take a 2-minute stretch and then we'll get started. Okay, Rabbi?